I'm excited about jumping into Sticks and Stones. Right before we do that, though, I want to let you know about something that's coming up on Tuesday of this week. The last couple months, we have kind of emphasized a little bit how important it is for those of us who have a relationship with Jesus, who have been changed, transformed by our Christian faith, to share that with other people and to remember what it was like before we had that relationship and therefore to have compassion for those who still don't have it. And here's the challenge. For many of us, actually sharing our faith one-on-one is not something we are especially gifted at. In fact, very few people have a great gift of just sitting down over a cup of coffee and just kind of leading someone to understand why Christianity might matter to them. So for the last couple of years, we've had a tool here that we've used to help people, and all you have to do is kind of invite someone to be a part of it and be willing to join with them, and we've seen a lot of lives get transformed by this. So we want you to know more about that. It's called Alpha, and we have an Alpha preview. This isn't the full thing starts at the end of April, but we have an Alpha preview that we'd love to invite you to that's happening this Tuesday. Alpha is a place where we do talk to people about what Christianity is, but it's also a really open environment for people to bring all their questions, all their concerns, push back big time any skepticism that they have, and have a great conversation about that. And there are certainly people who come through Alpha and find it interesting and helpful, but they don't choose to follow after Jesus at the end, but we also have a lot of people who come through it and they actually choose to get baptized at the end. And so if you have someone in your life, a loved one, a family member, those two things hopefully are the same, but if you have a loved one or a family member or a coworker, and you're like, man, I've really felt a burden to let this person know about my faith, but I don't know how to approach them. Alpha may be the right solution for you. So we're doing a preview this Tuesday. This is not for you to invite someone to. This is for you to check it out for yourself so you can know if it's the right thing for you. So this Tuesday night from 6:30 to 8:30 p.m., there's a meal involved at every Alpha, so we're going to actually have food. And so if you would register on our website, vervecity.church, on that homepage, if you're planning on coming, that would help us a lot. There's nothing worse than people showing up for food and not having enough. And there's nothing better than being on staff here and having too much, because then we get leftovers the next day. So please sign up and let us know. There's also childcare provided if you'd like that. And then later this month when Alpha starts off, when it kicks off in full, we'll have both an on-campus version and an off-campus version that happens in a local restaurant. So if you have friends who might be interested in faith, or people maybe who've walked away from faith, they're close to you, and you haven't been sure how to talk to them about that, Alpha may be great for them, but I want you to have confidence that it would be really good. So I think you should come Tuesday to check it out. Listen, one other thing I wanted to mention on this. The younger you are, the busier you are probably right now. I get that, especially if you have young kids, that kind of thing. Like, so a lot of you who are in your 30s and 40s, even late 20s, like you have friends who over the last several years have either walked away from faith or they're not sure about faith. And you're like, I do not have time to invite them and come to be a part of Alpha. I just want to encourage you who are younger, especially like people, you're at a formidable age right now, where literally your friends are moldable. We're all thinking together right at this age, like, what is the rest of my life going to look like? What kind of parent do I want to be? What kind of faith example do I or do I not want to have for my kids? It's a great age, even though you're very busy, to try and invite a friend and be a part of this. So if that's you, I just want to encourage you to consider coming this Tuesday, getting a preview, and seeing if this is the kind of environment you'd be comfortable inviting someone into. It's for all ages, but I just know that the younger you are, the more likely you are to be like, I don't have time for that. I just want to encourage you to consider the possibility that you do, to at least come to the preview and check it out. You're not committing to anything by coming to the preview except for dinner and great conversation on that night. So that's Alpha. It's coming up this Tuesday, the preview. Sticks and Stones. I want to talk about words today. Probably you've heard the phrase before, sticks and stones can break my bones, but words will never hurt me. And you know, and I know, that that's not true. Words are incredibly powerful. The meaning of words is powerful. The way we use our words is powerful. A few years ago, one of my kids, when they were about 6 years old, we were at dinner one night. They asked to be excused to go use the bathroom. And then they were taking a really long time. And so I went and knocked on the door, and I said, hey, bud, everything okay in there? And my six-year-old goes, yeah, Dad, I think I'm pregnant. I said, do you mean constipated? Yeah, I mean constipated. Like, I'm having a hard time going to the bathroom. Got it, right. Okay, so word meanings, right? Hard. Hard when you're growing up, the meaning of words matter. How you use your words then also matter. In fact, as you learned more words, you were capable of using them better and to fuller effect. You learned at some point, probably at a fairly young age, that you could say something to someone and just your words could have a really positive or really negative impact depending on the words that you chose. And so I'll bet if I were to sit down with you over a cup of coffee and I were to ask you, like, hey, what is something hurtful that someone said to you when you were a kid? I'll bet without having to think very hard, you could come up with 2, 3, 4 examples. I'll give you one of mine. Because I made a list this week. Well, it's a fun exercise to make down a list of the way people have been rude and mean to you over the years. Let me tell you. I wrote down just a quick list, just 4 or 5 that came to mind from my childhood. I'm sure I could have made a lot more. But here's one. When I was in 4th grade, I started playing little league basketball, little kids basketball. And I had not played up until then. I was totally newcomer to it. But I had some friends who were playing. Now, my friends had been playing for several years up until then. And I grew up in this very small town. So my whole team was like, was 6 players. We had, you know, 5 of us on the court. And then one would sub in, you know, and that was it. Every game, we were exhausted. And I really loved playing. I played for 2 years in Little League basketball. And I had fun. And I was having fun with my friends. And I thought it was really great. When I was in 6th grade, I got into a fight with one of those friends. His name is Casey. So Casey, if you're watching, I still remember this and you've ruined my life. So Casey and I were fighting one day and I said, I don't even remember what I said. Casey might remember what I said, but I said something rude. And then Casey, he did the mic drop moment. He looked at me and said, "You know what, Josh? You sucked at basketball too and we just never told you." And he walked away. Man, that hurt. And that led me to practice, too. I was like, I'm not going to suck at basketball anymore. So I practiced, and I practiced, and I practiced. And that's how I eventually made it to the NBA. So, but that's how I eventually played on my high school team. I mean, that was the thing that got into my ear. Like it really hurt my feelings. Because I knew I wasn't the best on the team, and I wasn't the most experienced. But I didn't know, like, were they talking about how bad I was behind my back? Were they like that really hurt my feelings. And when something like that happens to you, when somebody says something like that, it kind of cuts at you, you have an opportunity, right? You may choose to grow from it. You may just say like, well, that is not going to be true about me anymore. Or it could be defeating. You can feel like, man, I actually thought I was good at that or that I was better at that. That was a strength of mine. You could feel defeated. Or it could just be the kind of thing that like ends up being an ego hit for you for the rest of your life. I know that's strange to think about, but I'll bet there are people who said some things to you in elementary school, middle school, or high school that you either had to, as you became an adult, had to work through over the years, or that you still have in the back of your head when certain moments happen to you. That's the power of words. Words can build up, words can destroy. Sticks and stones can hurt your bones, but words can absolutely destroy you. And so this is not new, this concept, right? The scriptures in Proverbs, the Hebrew Bible, the Old Testament, says this in chapter 18, verses 20 through 21. Wise words satisfy like a good meal. The right words bring satisfaction. The tongue can bring death or life. Those who love to talk will reap the consequences. Jesus, actually, when he's criticizing the Pharisees, he says that this is one of the greatest rap disses of all time. He says their throats are like open graves, meaning like what comes out of your mouth, right? Like what comes up out of you is deadly. It kills, it destroys. And he's just really, what he's doing that is he's taking a passage like this and he's giving some life to it, some structure to it. Like the tongue can bring death or life. There was a phrase I heard years ago, and a few people have said it over the years, but the very first person I heard say it was a rabbi by the name of Abraham Joshua Heschel. It was a very simple phrase, and I've never forgotten it ever since. And the phrase is just that words create worlds. Words create worlds. We say things, and then the things we say actually create worlds for the people around us. For instance, I want you to think back to whoever raised you, parents, grandparents, aunts, uncles, whoever it was that brought you up. They said things all the time about all kinds of topics. They shared information with you. Sometimes they were directly teaching you, like they pulled you aside and they said, like, here's how the world works. Sometimes, though, it wasn't like they were directly teaching you. You just overheard them talking about things. Your children, by the way, and I know this because I have 2 of them, your children are always listening. Life's like a horror movie. They're always, always listening. Sometimes they even have noise-canceling headphones on, but they learn how to click the little button that turns it off, and then they're still, and you don't think they're listening, and they are, right? They're always listening. So sometimes we learn, not because someone said, here, let me teach you this thing. We just learn how the world works by overhearing those who raise us discuss how they think the world works. For instance, what are some of the things that your family or whoever brought you up, what are some of the things that they taught you about money? Right? Did you get taught from an early age that the world was abundant and that there was great riches out there that you could go and steward and use for yourself and your family and be generous to others? Did you have an abundance mindset growing up? Or maybe your parents or your grandparents taught you that actually we live in a very scarce world
and you have to hoard and take everything you possibly can and save it up and store it because you never know when the worst might happen. And so the world's a very frightening place and you've got to hold on to every cent that you make for yourself, right? Or was it somewhere in between those things? What were the kinds of things that you were taught, whether implicitly or explicitly, about money? Or about marriage? What did the people who raised you teach you about marriage? What did they teach you about it by talking about maybe the person that they were married to, right? How do they speak of their spouse? Did they speak of their spouse in terms of like a partnership and we're in this together and we love one another and yep, we work through our differences and we have communication? Was it that kind of way of talking about things? Or did they talk about their spouse almost in a resentful way or as an opponent of them? Or like, we got to do this thing, but your mom's not going to like it, so just don't tell her, okay? So like, keep that, like, how did they talk about that? Did marriage seem like an exciting adventure to go on or the end of life as you know it? What did marriage seem like to you? Like, based on how the people talked to you about it, right? What about faith? Maybe for those of you raised in like a Christian environment, was faith a beautiful relationship with Jesus that you would invite other people to, like a great meal? Or was faith constantly under siege by a secular world and what you have to do is circle the wagons and protect it lest they knock it down? There are these messages that you pick up on from the people who raise you. And whether they explicitly or implicitly teach it, like, their words create worlds. You see the world particular ways because of the way that people around you and the media you consume talk about it. And the way that that happens actually very much plays into framing the world for you. And you frame the world for other people by the words that you speak. In the book of James is a New Testament writer. He's the brother of Jesus. He did not seem to believe that Jesus was actually God while Jesus was alive. You can understand why. If you thought that your sibling was trying to be your Lord, you'd be like, no thanks, right? Like, that's not going to happen. Like, we got to share a room, man. Like, that's not happening, right? But after Jesus rose from the dead, James started to believe that Jesus was actually God. And so he ends up becoming an early leader in the church in the first century. And he writes a little book about what it looks like to live a life that's really given over to God toward the back of the New Testament. And I want to look today in that book in James chapter 3. Because in James chapter 3, it is the longest discussion that we have in the New Testament of the words you use, the tongue, and how it can be great or how it can be destructive. And I just want us to basically today meditate on this teaching a little bit, and then we'll talk about a few ways to apply it, and then we'll be done. So James chapter 3, starting with verse number 1. The brother of Jesus writes this: "Dear brothers and sisters, not many of you should become teachers in the church, for we who teach will be judged more strictly." I got to be honest, I don't love this verse, okay? Those of us who teach in the church, not our favorite thing, okay? But it also makes a ton of sense. What he's saying is, look, those of you who teach in the church, you have some amount, right? You have some amount of influence, and you need to steward that influence well. Because you claim to be pointing to the goodness of God. And so if you are lying, if you are deceitful, if you don't steward it well, if you don't live what you teach, like, you'll be judged more harshly for that than other people. And we should be. We should be. So he's naming that right up front, that the words that those of you teachers in the church use matter. But he goes on to talk about principles, I think, that apply to everybody. He says, "Indeed, we all make many mistakes." This is one of my favorite verses in the Bible, baby. We all make many mistakes. Yes, amen. I agree with that. "For if we could control our tongues, we would be perfect and could also control ourselves in every other way." I just want to name how important I think that verse is. If we can control our tongues, we can control ourselves. If we control our tongues, we control ourselves. But the tongue is one of the most difficult things for us to control. We often use it in ungracious, unhelpful, and in hurtful ways. And so he goes on to unpack this even more. "We can make a large horse go wherever we want by means of a small bit in its mouth. And a small rudder makes a huge ship turn wherever the pilot chooses to go, even though the winds are strong. In the same way, the tongue is a small thing that makes grand speeches." So he's using a couple of illustrations here, right? Like, you have these large boats, and there were certainly large boats in James's time. Paul, the apostle Paul, was escorted on a boat that carried over 200 people. We believe that the Roman soldiers were able to get on boats that held up to 1,000 soldiers at one time. So they know about large boats. And they also know that, right, there's a very small rudder that ends up being the thing that steers the ships. Similar with horses. You have a small bit in their mouth and control this really large animal. A couple of years ago, I took my boys, Jack and William, to West Texas. We were going to visit family in East Texas, so we drove all the way from California to East Texas, and that is the last time we'll do that. So
But one of the things we did on the way out was we went horseback riding. And this was a lot of fun. Will was a little bit too small to get his own horse, so he is the most chillaxed child on a horse I have ever seen here. And he basically just did this all day. And this is one of the owners of the ranch, so she actually knows what she's doing, unlike me and my son. They told us it had rained a lot the couple weeks beforehand. Very unusual that they got this amount of rain for that time of year. And so instead of totally dry, brown desert, there was grass everywhere. And so they told us beforehand, hey, the horses have been well fed today, but they're going to want to stop at every patch of grass that they see and eat some more. But if you let them do that, it's going to slow us down, and they're going to get overstuffed and lethargic the longer the day goes. So you need to pull up on their reins and not let them eat. And then they gave me the most stubborn horse that they had in the whole ranch. His name is Apache, and I still have nightmares about this horse, okay? So he's I know he looks pretty. He's that horse in the middle. He looks pretty. Don't let looks deceive you, okay? That is a dumpster fire of a horse right there. So we're out on the trail, and Apache keeps trying to eat grass, and so I take the reins, right? And I'm supposed to be able to just gently pull up. Well, that didn't work at all. So they're like, no, you can pull harder. You're not going to hurt him. I was like, okay. So I just kept pulling up. Jack's horse as well, Jack, that's the black horse on the far right there, his name was Red. Red also, black horse named Red, I loved it. So he also kept eating, and Jack, probably 5 minutes in, just gave up. Like, he just didn't even care. But theoretically, but then I saw what she was doing. She knew what she was doing. We did not, right? This the rider that Will was on. And so she could actually use the reins and the bit in the mouth and everything to control this huge, massive animal, way bigger than she is, weighs way more. And that's the beauty of something so small actually being able to control something so large. James is just basically trying to say, in the same way that the bit, that the reins can control the horse, so your tongue ends up controlling all of you. Therefore, if you could learn to control your tongue, you could learn to control yourself. If you were able to actually get a handle on what it is that you say and the worlds that you create, you would be able to control all of you. So this ends up being like a really small thing that actually leads to a really big thing. And that's the point he's making. He goes on, but a tiny spark can set a great forest on fire. And among all the parts of the body, the tongue is a flame of fire. It is a whole world of wickedness corrupting your entire body. It can set your whole life on fire, for it is set on fire by hell itself. So this is a very strong verse. A few things on this. First of all, the word he's using for hell there is the word Gehenna. So if you look in the original Greek, it's the word Gehenna. Gehenna was a garbage dump outside of Jerusalem in the first century when he's writing this. Gehenna was kind of the city garbage where you would throw everything and it would be smoke, it would be on fire, it would light on fire. And the point of that fire was to destroy or to annihilate the stuff that was thrown into it. So when he's saying that it's set on fire by hell itself, here's what he means by that. He's saying, like Gehenna, this dumpster fire, your tongue can actually become like that, destructive. Your tongue can be a thing that destroys, in other words. And it doesn't take much. Like, your little tongue can destroy way bigger things than it is. Like, a tiny spark can set a great forest on fire. I don't know how many of you remember 2020, the year we had a few years ago. Great year, wasn't it? Like, just banner year for all of us. We remember it, right? Got to spend a lot of time hanging out at home. Many of us experimented with homeschooling our kids for the first time. That was awesome. Every day was just a joy to wake up to. It was just so good. But then in September of 2020, after all of the pandemic and the political tension and everything else, in September 2020, in Riverside County, there was a couple that decided to hold a gender reveal party. And they, some of you remember, they used a smoke bomb to reveal the gender. And it was that week that it got up to 115 degrees here. Do we remember this a little bit? Some of us? Yeah, some of you have blocked this out completely, I can tell. Good on you. Sorry, I'm bringing it back up. It started a fire that ended up burning 23,000 acres, 5 homes, and 15 buildings down. And then for those of us who didn't live that far, you know, it was over in the Riverside County, for those of us who didn't live it did create like smoke in the air that we got like ashes like falling on our car here and all over Southern California. It was this little spark, little gender reveal party. By the way, gender reveal parties, maybe don't use pyrotechnics, okay? There's other ways to talk about your baby. And what happened? It caused mass chaos and mass destruction for everybody because of this little bitty spark. And this is just the other point that James is making. Look, it's like, small rudder, big boat, right? Small bit, large horse. Small spark, huge forest. This is the power of the tongue. Control the tongue, control everything. Goes on. People can tame all kinds of animals, birds, reptiles, and fish, but no one can tame the tongue. It is restless and evil, full of deadly poison. Sometimes it praises our Lord and Father, and sometimes it curses those
who have been made in the image of God. In other words, like with the same tongue, you can praise the creator and curse his creation. That's what the tongue is capable of. It's both good and evil. And it's strange that the same thing is capable of doing two diametrically opposed actions. It's strange. Where I had when I was in middle school, I had a friend, and he was using some coarse language out we had sports time. So we're out doing sports time, and a friend of mine was using some coarse language, and the coach came over, and he said a thing that, you probably have it around here too. I grew up in East Texas, so I heard this kind of thing growing up a lot. He said this, "Boy, you kiss your mother with that mouth," right? And my friend was like, "Do I make out with my mom, coach? Is that what you're asking me?" "Coach, do you make out with your mom? Gross." Like, it was like that kind of thing, right? But he's basically saying, look, the same mouth that you're using to say all that stuff, is that the same mouth you use to bless your mom? It's the same mouth, right? And the reality is, James is saying, yes, with the same exact mouth, we'll praise God and curse his creation. Do the same. And he goes on to say, basically, it shouldn't be like this, right? And so blessing and cursing pouring out of the same mouth. Surely, my brothers and sisters, this is not right. Does the spring of water bubble out with both fresh water and bitter water? Does a fig tree produce olives and a grapevine produce figs? No, and you can't draw fresh water from a salty spring. You can't draw fresh water from a salty spring. Which leads me to a question. How salty is your spring? Right? Do you find yourself often thinking about what it is you want to say and how you can bless others with what you say, even if you have to correct others, right? This doesn't mean never correct people. The scripture is full of both truth and grace, and truth presented in gracious ways. Sometimes you have to have a hard conversation. Sometimes you have to tell someone that they are wrong. Sometimes you have to correct behavior. That can all happen. But does that happen from a fresh spring? Or at the core of kind of like your speech, at the core of who you are, is there a saltiness, a cynicism, a pessimism, maybe a bitterness or an anger that you tend to speak from? What's the source? What is your source like? Because the words you choose to use with other people and the way that you choose to bless them or not will very much derive from our source. And let's be honest, like a lot of us, right? Someone dumped salt in our spring. Like we were doing okay at one point, but words create worlds. And as we were growing up, other people gave us a really cynical, pessimistic view of the world. And so we gathered that that's what the world is all about. And so it just kind of became our worldview as well. And we didn't realize that the words we were taking in were creating our picture of the world at the time. We were just being formed by it in ways that were pretty unconscious for us. But now at this point, our spring is pretty salty, and we have a hard time speaking fresh words because like the source ends up being the problem. A few years after his death, Abraham Joshua Heschel's daughter, Susanna Heschel, wrote about more of what he meant when he said the phrase, "Words create worlds." And this is what she said. "Words," he often wrote, "are themselves sacred. God's tool for creating the universe and our tools for bringing holiness or evil into the world." He used to remind us that the Holocaust did not begin with the building of crematoria, and Hitler did not come to power with tanks and guns. It all began with uttering evil words, with defamation, with language and propaganda. Hitler created the kind of world with his words, where it was a logical next step to annihilate a people group. Because he used constant propaganda and words that would show like the world, he stoked people up on fear and anger. And he just showed them that like with these people around, like this, the world is not going to be the kind of world you want it to be. I've been reading this book called Cultish. And I just finished it recently. I talked about it a couple weeks ago, actually. It's been very interesting to me because it's taken different cults throughout the world and it's explored the language that those cults have used in order to gain power over their people. And every cult has this in common, that they use a common language, right? There's a vocabulary, a common vocabulary that ends up becoming a part of it. And that's true whether it's like a religious cult that ends in like mass suicide like Jonestown, or if it's, you know, Peloton. Peloton riders use it too, right? If you've ever watched like Alex Toussaint or some of those other Peloton riders, like coaches, like they have certain words they want to use. You know, "I didn't come this morning to work out, I came to outwork," like that kind of stuff. And you're like, yeah! And you just like, you know, it pumps you up inside, but you feel like, oh, I know the this phrase. I'm here. I'm like, I'm a part of this, right? And so CrossFit would be similar. And by the way, how do you know that someone takes CrossFit? Oh, don't worry. They'll tell you. So it's like all these different things. They create a vocabulary, and it's a vocabulary that ends up like if you're on the inside of it, you find belonging, right? You find belonging. And so this is what cults do, but it's what all groups really tend to do. But one of the things that they mentioned in the book that was helpful, I had not heard of this before, was what's called a thought-terminating cliche. A thought-terminating cliche. I wasn't aware of this phrase. But basically, what it means is it's a cliche that someone says in order to stop thoughts or in order to stop questions, right? So it's a cliche that someone uses, like, so let's say someone is struggling with something, or they have a question about something, like, I'm not sure I like the way you're running things, or whatever. Like, there's these cliches you can say to get people to stop thinking too hard about it and to stop talking about it. So, thought-terminating cliche. So, a few examples of it. You've probably heard the phrase, hey, it is what it is, right? Someone asks a question, well, why are we doing it like this? Ah, it is what it is, right? That just means, shut up, this is the way it is, don't ask any more questions, right? That's what it means. So, yeah, it is what it is, right? Okay. Maybe you've heard, everything happens for a reason. That is a thought-terminating cliche if there ever is one. By the way, not a biblical concept, everything happens for a reason. Not a biblical concept. I don't have time to prove that to you today. Just trust me. All right, so just trust me. Thought-terminating cliche, okay? You got it? All right, so here's another one. Here's another one in Christian circles that you may hear a lot. I've certainly heard a lot. The Bible says it, that settles it. Well, why do we do this? Or why do we think that? Or why do we say, well, the Bible says it, that settles it. Yeah, but sometimes the Bible says it like this here, but it seems to say it like this. Bible says it. That settles it. Thought terminating cliche. And what the reason you do that is to stop people from talking out or questioning the world that you've so carefully constructed for them. Because words create worlds, and words can tear down worlds. And if you've created a flimsy world, it's easy to tear it down if people start using their words to question it. So you want to terminate those thoughts, and you come up with these cliches to do that. That's how cults tend to work. It's why, by the way, it's so important for us here at Versity Church to be a culture that embraces questions and embraces people asking them and has environments like Alpha where people can go ask questions. Like, we don't want a flimsy world that we just protect. We believe that the world that Jesus invited us into is robust, and it's thoughtful, and it's logical, and it's life-giving. So yes, that's how Hitler manifested what he did. He created a world for them with his words, and that gave them a permission structure in order to go and do the heinous acts that they did. She concludes by saying this, words create worlds, he used to tell me when I was a child, and they must be used very carefully. Some words, once having been uttered, gain eternity and can never be withdrawn. I love this sentence, and I hate this reality. Some words, once having been uttered, gain eternity. I'll bet if we were to sit down and I were to ask you, like, hey, what did someone tell you at some point in your life, something negative, that gained eternity for you? Like, it's still in there. You may even be able to talk about all the ways you know it's not true. It's still there, though. I'll bet you could come up with several things. And I'll bet if I said, hey, what words have you uttered that gained eternity for someone else? I'll bet it'd be a lot harder for you to determine what that is, but I'll bet you've uttered them. Some words gain eternity. Now this can be a good thing. Some positive words gain eternity as well. The only reason I'm up here preaching to you this morning is because a few people, when I was young, pulled me aside and told me some version of, when you speak, people listen to you. I believe you have a gift of leadership. Something like that. And at some point, that led me on a pathway that has wound up where I am today. And so that's the reason, though, because someone saw something in me and called it out. And I hope that we can call out the goodness that we see in other people as well, because you have no idea the amazing, powerful, positive impact that you speaking encouragement and life into a young person's life could actually net over the course of the rest of their life. You have no idea. And we also have no idea the amount of damage that saying the wrong thing to the wrong person at the wrong time can net as well. Words create worlds. And some of our words, once uttered, they gain eternity. So I just want to very quickly, as we wrap up here, look at four quick things that we can do, I think, to help put some of the teachings of James into practice And they're not, I don't think they're mind-blowing, but if we were really committed to doing them regularly, I think they could be life-altering. So here's the first one. Monitor your word output. Monitor your word output. Actually become cognizant of what you say. For many of us, we just don't think much about what it is that we say. And so we'll just kind of speak half-assed. And some of us are worse about this than others. If you're an extrovert, you're probably a bit of a verbal processor. There's a good chance that that's you. And you have to just kind of talk things out sometimes to even figure out what you believe. I mean, and I'm like that. I had an employee, a friend of mine worked with me several years ago. And when we first started working together, apparently he did not know how to take my verbal processing sometimes. And one day I was talking to him about a concept and he just started laughing. And I said, "What's wrong?" And he said, "Nothing, man. I'm listening to you talk," and I said, "It used to really stress me out when I first joined the staff because, like, you would say one thing, and then a minute later, you'd disagree with yourself." And I'm like, "I think there's, like, multiple personalities in there." He's like, and then I realized you just have to talk it out. And I was like, "Oh, yeah. I'm glad you realized that." So I learned that sometimes when I talk to staff, I have to say, "Hey, just a thought. Like, this is not real. Like, don't freak out yet, right? Like, don't do anything with this yet. I just need to talk. I need to see what I think. I need to say it out loud, right?" And so you got to monitor that stuff, though. Because if you're not careful, the thing that to you felt fairly, you know, no big deal, innocuous, like, it can feel way heavier to other people. So you just need to monitor your word output. And I got to say this too. If you're a leader in your family or in your organization or in your school or on your team, whatever that, if you're a leader, if you have people who report to you, people who look to you to be a decision maker, oftentimes your whisper is a shout. And you would do well to remember that. Your whisper is a shout. So when you go to correct somebody, and you should, we have to correct people sometimes. We have to be corrected sometimes. If you go to correct somebody, if you're in a position of especially organizational authority over them, or even just, you know, structural authority, mind authority, whatever that is, just recognize, like, if you come down really hard on somebody from that position, that can feel like 1,000 pounds heavier to them than you think it does. Your whisper ends up being a shout. So notice yourself, monitor your word output. Check and see what it is that you're saying. Like, are you speaking words of blessing or words of curse? Here's another one. Monitor your word input. Monitor your word input. So important. Why is this so important? Because what we absorb from other people and from the media form our inner well, right? We talked about well being fresh or salty. And saltiness sells. In fact, there's a concept called performative outrage. And if you've turned on the TV or listened to a podcast or just kind of scrolled the internet over the last few years, social media, Reddit, any of that stuff, like, you've seen this everywhere, performative outrage. This is when someone may have a real beef, okay, there's something that they're actually upset about, but then when they get on the television, they have to act like, if we don't fix this, this is the end of America, this is the end of the world, this is the end of democracy, this is the end of them, they're just blah, apoplectic about everything, right? Just blah. And so you watch them and you start to feel your own blood pressure rise and you'd think you'd be like, man, I should watch something else, but instead you're like, I need to watch more hours of this. Like, it's just, there's something that it draws us in. There's a dopamine effect that it has. Every 24-hour news station has figured out that this sells. And a huge portion of their programming is intentionally crafted to make you fearful and angry all the time. Every social media platform has determined that this stuff gets more eyeballs and more clicks than anything else. I don't know, if, for those of you who, you know, I'm old, right? So I'm in my 40s. For those of you who are much younger, I know that I'm solidly middle-aged. I remember when Facebook was only for people with a .edu email address, okay? You younger people aren't going to believe this, but Facebook used to be cool, okay? Used to, like if you had a Facebook account, like, wow, you got a Facebook, your school has Facebook? Like, it was a big deal. So in the early 2000s, that was a big deal. And then I remember when Facebook died. My mom got an account one day, and it was like, oh, party's over, got it. Okay, so this is, like, just for sharing pictures of babies now. Okay, understood. Like right, I remember that. So I'm old enough to remember when all of that happened. And used to social media, it truly was. Like, for those of you who remember, like 10, 15 years ago, social media really was people, like, taking pictures of their food and their feet and, you know, their friends and their kids and sticking them online and a bunch of people just, like little comments like, oh, he's growing so fast. Like, it was that was what Facebook was. And then they added the like button, and then all hell broke loose, okay? Because then you could like, dislike, and then it started to promote content. The algorithm started to promote content that was more more combative. And so people would then fight in the comments section, you know? And you knew you'd posted something really good if you had, like, 120 people fighting in the comments, right? Like, that was what people go. They did it for the likes, and they did it for the, and people just figured this out. And before long, I felt like our entire culture was saturated with performative outrage. If you marinate in performative outrage all the time, you will feel actual outrage much of the time. And this will absolutely, absolutely be a part of defining what words you end up using, how you see the world, whether your inner spring is fresh or salty. And so you just need to monitor your input. Look, I'm not telling you only consume media that fully 100% agrees with your value system. Look, I know it's probably impossible to find media that 100% agrees with your value system. I am trying to name this for you. Monitor what you're reading and what podcasts you're listening to and what social media you're scrolling and the movies that you're watching and the news that you consume, because people realized a long time ago that they could manipulate, raise money, and keep our eyeballs stuck on things that were angry and fear-driven. Don't become angry and fear-driven. Like it will change the way that you talk. And we gotta keep our attention on our will. So third, speak words of blessing. Speak words of blessing. Jesus did this all the time. Jesus would intentionally call out of somebody something good that he saw inside of them. And so there's a Roman centurion who tells him that he believes that Jesus could heal his servant at home. And Jesus says to this man, in front of a bunch of other people, "I haven't seen faith like this in all of Israel," which was a way of saying this Gentile has more faith than those of you who are Jewish and looking on, which would have been totally scandalous for them, right? So he's calling out the lack of faith that they have, but he is calling up the amazing faith of this centurion. And he does that for this man. There's a woman with an issue of blood who goes and touches Jesus' robe because she wants to be healed. And he turns around and he can tell that some power went out of him. He turns around and says, like, who touched my cloak? And she would have had an issue of blood. This would have made her unclean. She shouldn't have been around people. She shouldn't have been touching people. Like, she was a Jewish woman, ashamed that she'd been dealing with this issue of bleeding for years and years. Had probably gone to the doctor, sought medical treatment, all that kind of stuff. And she hears about Jesus and, like, this is my chance to maybe be healed. She wants to just get healed by him and then slide away into the background, right? She has been unfit to be out in public and around people for years at this point. So he turns around and calls her out specifically. And then she's lived a life of shame and embarrassment for being culturally unclean in that culture for the last however many years. And so she just turns around, she just confesses right in front of him. It was me. I did. I'm so sorry. So she was going to move from living a life. She was healed. She was going to live a life of shame for having an issue of blood to a life of shame that she went and grabbed something that wasn't rightfully hers from Jesus and snuck away. That's where she's moving. Jesus instead calls her daughter. It's the only time he calls anyone daughter in the entire New Testament. And sends her away in grace and peace. She doesn't have to leave with her tail tucked between her leg. He calls her daughter instead. And in doing so, her medical history was redefined, but she as a person was redefined as well. Peter betrays Jesus 3 times on the night that he's arrested and tried and crucified. And he's so ashamed of it. He's going to live with that for the rest of his life. But when Jesus raises from the dead, he has breakfast with Peter on the beach, and he gives him 3 opportunities to tell Jesus that he loves him. And in doing so, he restores him. Constantly, Jesus is looking for ways to bless people, to affirm who they are, and to call out of them the good that he sees, and to forgive the evil that he knows lurks in their heart. He's doing this all the time, and you have an opportunity to do that as well. You have an opportunity to do that in your families. Like, don't let your kids get into their 20s, 30s, 40s, and beyond, and look back and feel like all you ever did was correct them. All you ever did was tell them what to do and what not to do. You need to be calling out the goodness that you see in them now. Your kids are always wanting you. Like, when my kids were real young, 4, 5, 6 years old, they were constantly like, "Dad, watch this. Dad, look at this. Dad, I made this painting. Dad, look at this Lego set I made." Like, they were constantly calling my attention. Now my oldest son is 11, and I've noticed he has stopped specifically asking for my attention as much as he did 5 or 6 years ago. He does not want it any less, though. Now I have to choose to go and say, "Hey, what are you building there, bud? Hey, what are you working on there, bud?" And then he'll light up. "Oh, Dad, look at this. I had this idea, and I made this little video over here, and I think this is that. I need some audio. You can help me find some audio. I'll be happy to help you find some audio." Bless your children with your attention. Bless your coworkers, your spouse, your friends with your attention. Bless them by calling out the good. "Oh, that's a great painting. Oh, that's a great job. Oh, it was a wonderful meal. Oh, you did a great job on this report." Bless people. And then when you need to correct, they will receive that correction from a person of blessing, and it will matter more to them. You have earned their trust. And here's the other thing about blessing. Be a person of truth and honesty. Do not lie to people, because lying often feels like it's the way to get out of something or to gain something. But what actually happens with lying is that you lose it. You lose trust, right? Words are powerful. And lying, if you become known as a person who lies, you will lose the power of your words. Don't give up influence with people. Don't lose the power of your words. Be honest with people. I know that seems like such a basic 101 thing, but as I've gotten older, I realize like so many adults learned a habit of lying, fibbing, fudging the truth early on in life, and it became just a helpful solution to so many things, and they never dropped the habit once they become adult age. Be committed to honesty, because when you're honest, your words gain more and more power, and speak words of blessing. Finally, speak words of thanksgiving. Speak words of thanksgiving. So much of the time when our inner spring is salty instead of fresh, the reason it's salty is because we live a life without gratitude. We start to think that we don't have enough, or we're going through such a hard time, or whatever it may be, and we don't live a life of thanksgiving. And I just want to encourage you to speak words of thanksgiving. Two really practical things you can do this week if you find that you have a hard time living a life of thanksgiving. And listen, I talked to a friend of mine earlier this week who is a part of our church, and he said he knows he needs to live with more gratitude, but he's having a hard time doing it. And I think one of the things we talked about is he was feeling it like a legalistic thing, like. God says you should be grateful. Be more grateful. Like it was like, you know, that kind of, I need to do this. I just need to accomplish it, right? But it's not that. God wants you to live a life of gratitude and thanksgiving, not because he commanded it, but because he knows if you live a life of gratitude and thanksgiving, you will live a better life. Life is better when we're more thankful. So two little tips I'll give you if you struggle with this, because it's so, oftentimes, it's so easy to see the problems in the world. First of all, make a list. Make a list of 100 things you're grateful for. Just spend some time, take an evening this week, take an early morning this week, do it this afternoon when you get home. Make a list of 100 things you're grateful for. The first 7 or 8 will come really easily. After 15, you'll be out of ideas. At 30, you'll feel like it was a heart, gut-wrenching assignment. Once you get into the 50s and 60s, weirdly, it starts getting easier. I don't know why. And you start to write down other things pretty fast. So all together, it doesn't actually take that long, but it does feel like death in the first third at some point, okay? But once you get through it, you will just back 30,000 foot level and just like, man, I have a lot to be thankful for. Of course you do. Of course you do. And look, I know some of you may have ADHD, and you're like, I can't sit for more than 20 seconds. Okay, first of all, you're doing great this morning. I gotta tell you, well done there. Secondly, like if you find that you can't do it, like here's another idea. This is a real simple one, okay? Choose to thank God for some number of things every day. And here's a great, just start with 5. I'm going to thank God for 5 things today. Just as the day goes on, right? This doesn't require you to sit down. You don't have to make a list. You have to hold a pen in your hand. You don't have to do that. Just choose to thank God for 5 things that day. Could be that in the morning. You get in your car and you thank God, oh, thank you that I have this transportation to get to my place of work. Or it could be, you know, in the afternoon, you grab a lunch with a coworker or with a family member or even by yourself and you're just like, oh, thank God for the sandwich or for this salad or for whatever, like thank you for this. It could be in the evenings. You decide to thank God for what God is doing, in the life of your son. Or you pick up your daughter at school and you're like, oh, God, thank you that you're you know, she had a good day at school today, or she learned something today, or that we don't have to do homeschool anymore. Thank you so much, God, that school is back in session. Like, there should be all kinds of things that you are thankful for. And just to name a few things throughout the day, what it allows you to do, it allows you to get more of a headspace, heart space of gratitude and thanksgiving. And when you're able to do that, you are more likely to speak words of blessing and grace to others. Words create worlds. And you probably don't realize how powerful your words are. This week, may you be blessed and may you be a blessing. May you give thanks and may you do for others that which is thanked. This morning, as we conclude, we're going to sing a song of thanksgiving to the Lord. Just a way of thanking him. A reminder as we conclude today of the many ways that he has blessed us. For those who've put your trust in Jesus, for those who've followed after him, I thought we'd end today with just a prayer, a song prayer of thanksgiving to the God who has given us so much that we may leave this place today and bless the world with our words.
Thank you for listening to the Verve City Church Weekly Messages podcast. To learn more about Verve City Church, including info about our church ministries and ways to get involved, visit vervecity.church. To stay up to date with our weekly messages, make sure you subscribe and leave a review so others can find our messages of hope and encouragement. Thanks again for listening. We'll catch you next week.